Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Assistant Professor Zachary Hirst, legal historian in the Department of Classics at the University of Colorado, Boulder. This is episode CLXXXVI, Prescriptions. Octavian, Mark Antony, and Lepidus have secured their alliance against Caesar's assassins, and since they have the control of Rome, it's time to get rid of any competition. Prescribing an enemy means that they will likely be executed, and their personal fortunes can be confiscated and put towards paying soldiers. And the Second Triumvirate makes full use of this. Here's Zachary Hirst.
Okay, so it's 43 BCE, and we've got to figure out kind of why prescription is the remedy for the moment. And there are two things you've got to remember. The first is this is an extremely paranoid environment. The Second Triumvirate is built really off of Caesar's funeral pyre. It's built out of this sort of sudden, presumably quite shocking assassination of a major political figure in the Senate House. Presumably, all three members of the Second Triumvirate, so you've got the man who will later become Augustus, who I tend to conventionally call Octavian and will be for the purposes of this story. We've got Mark Antony and we've got Lepidus. No one really cares about Lepidus, but we need to mention him. All of them have reason to think that there are enemies all over the city of Rome, potentially very wealthy, very highly placed enemies, right? Mm. That's a paranoid environment that sort of calls out for a purge. It's a way to sort of quickly kind of hobble Republicans who may still be existing in the city and may present a real threat to the Second Triumvirate. The second, though, and this is always something you have to remember about prescriptions, is that the Triumvirate needs money. Brutus and Cassius have already fled. They are leading a major Republican movement centered in what we now call Greece and Macedonia. And these guys need to raise an army to go and fight them. That's expensive. And prescriptions are not just executions. The goods of the proscript, the goods of the person prescribed, are forfeit to the state, I guess we might call it. And it's interesting that that language is showing up in people like Appian and Plutarch. We'll talk about that later. But this is fundraising. Prescriptions are not just a way to take out potential enemies of the current ruling junta. They're also a way to get money to support military operations. And so when you have a paranoid leadership class that also desperately needs money, that's when prescriptions start to seem like a viable political option.
So what is the context of prescriptions then for Rome? This isn't a new phenomenon. They've turned up before the Second Triumvirate. So how have they been used in the past?
Our history on this is bad, and interestingly bad. The authors who talk in the greatest detail about prescriptions tend to be writing 200 to 300 years after the fact. We're using figures like Appian, we're using Cassius Dio, we're using Plutarch's biographies. These are all figures writing way later, whose understanding of prescription is really shaped by later imperial history and later memory traditions. But all of them describe prescription as happening. Interestingly, some of them place the first one pretty early. You'll see language related to prescription being used about the conflicts with the Gracchi in the late 2nd century BCE. But basically, everyone agrees the first mass prescription, the model for what's being described here, is happening under Sulla. Mm. Now, Sulla Felix is a sort of traditionalist, anti-populist leader who takes the city of Rome by force around 80 BCE. Comes in and almost immediately purges the city of his political opponents. Now, my sort of personal favorite account of the Sullan prescriptions comes from a fragment of the much longer and kind of damaged and complicated history of Cassius Dio. And we lack some of the context for it, but this fragment, which is pretty long, describes Sulla as innovating on earlier methods of political murder by putting tablets in the center of the Roman Forum. On these tablets are going to be names, the proscribed. This is coming from the root of sort of writing. It's the same root as scribe. It's the same root as description. These names are forfeit. Mm-hmm. What that means is not that they're going to be executed. Prescription isn't really an execution. It means that anyone who sees them is empowered to kill them and to turn them in for a reward. Further, anyone who helps them, and this part is not made as explicit in Dio, anyone who helps them is subject to the same penalty. The prescription expands to include any ally of the prescribed. In essence, this becomes sort of a mass private warfare. You have people killing each other in the streets. Sort of the corollary to this, obviously, is a prescribed person has nothing to lose and will probably be armed, trying to get out of the city as effectively as they can, and killing anyone who stops them, because why wouldn't you, right? Why? What are they going to do, prescribe you again? It's basically a complete breakdown of social order, all done without any real commitment of resources by the state, which, you know, is going to be paying rewards, but those rewards are going to be more than compensated for by the prescribed property reverting to whoever is the prescriber, in this case, Sulla, right? In addition, it's not like people had IDs and could be easily identified. There was enormous confusion. Dio, and I believe this appears in Appian as well, describes fairly substantial confusion, just the wrong people being killed. There's a total breakdown of juridical signification, a total breakdown of people's ability to know who was who and to know who deserves punishment. Rome has killed people more brutally than it did under Sulla. It's maybe never killed people so randomly or so lawlessly. There's a chaos to prescription that seems to really stick in the minds of later authors and that makes them describe it as almost a horror movie.
But they did have, well, they had to assign some sort of reason for each individual being prescribed, didn't they? Because they were employing treason as being a reason.
I mean, they did sometimes. They didn't have to. It's very, very clear in Dio that it's just names. Whatever kind of deliberation is going on is happening outside of the level of the tablet. That deliberation is happening presumably in secret. It's definitely private. It's subject to no sort of control. What shows up is just a tablet with names on it. And I want to say it is Appian's account that has the material about sort of great houses persecuting them. Is that correct? Nope, it is Plutarch's biography of Sulla. I apologize for that. Makes very clear that some people are just showing up on the list because Sulla wants their money, right? It is not saying that on the list. It's just including a name, and people are left to sort of figure out reasons for themselves as they are trying to evade death.
So that's in 82 or 81 BCE that we're talking about. So that's living memory, I guess, of the older senators who are still alive in the time of the Second Triumvirate. So I'm surprised that they're willing to let it to get to the point where history is repeating itself, because this sounds like a terrible bloody time for people, especially at their level of society. Some of their parents would have been the ones prescribed, and their peers, because they would have been young men, but it doesn't sound like they had a lot of choice in the matter.
Well, I mean, you know, dear departed Julius Caesar had come from a family of the prescribed. This is absolutely a thing that is happening. There are major divisions among late Republican society. I personally always wonder whether these sort of horror that the prescriptions take on in these much later accounts, not that it's wrong. By all accounts, the sort of first century BC was a horrible time to be alive, and especially a horrible time to be rich. But whether the actual proscription itself is sort of breaking up this island of calm, which is kind of how it appears in the sources, that everything is sort of all right until the proscriptions occur. Political violence is endemic to this period. It's extremely chaotic. And I always wonder whether the horror of the proscription specifically isn't appearing in later authors who are using proscription as a device to sort of symbolize the wanton violence of the civil wars. It is very, very clear the Second Triumvirate undertook an enormous purge. It's worth remembering Caesar had probably undertaken some kinds of purges that we don't know nearly as much about, because Caesar tends to appear as a little bit more of a good guy in Augustan historiography. And like, as a result, I don't always feel like our understanding of the brutality of Julius Caesar is as well preserved.
So prescriptions were used between these two events, weren't they? And they didn't always necessarily indicate that somebody is going to be killed, but it's more about exile and confiscating goods, confiscating possessions. Is that about right? Or is that a misunderstanding?
I think a lot starts to depend on what you mean by prescription. People being sort of gotten rid of and their property taken, absolutely happening in the middle, absolutely going on. That's just a feature of late Republican political warfare. What I think is a little bit novel about Sulla, and I think what probably was not happening regularly between that and the Second Triumvirate, is the tablet. It's this weird technological innovation where you've got just sort of names in the forum, and if they appear there, kill them. That seems like less of a thing in between. It's not clear to me how people at that time would have understood that relative to other kinds of political violence, whereas they show up in our sources as sort of the bad thing.
There's a nice little quote that I've got here from Plutarch's Life of Sulla about Quintus Aurelius reading his own name on the list. Did you want to read that out?
Oh, God, with pleasure. And this is sort of where I'm getting this idea that like we really are just getting bare names, right? Quintus Aurelius, a quiet and inoffensive man who thought his only share in the general calamity was to condole with others in their misfortunes, came into the forum and read the list of the proscribed, and finding his own name there, said, "Ah, woe is me! My Alban estate is prosecuting me." And he had not gone far before he was dispatched by someone who had hunted him down. Now, a quick note there. That line, "my estate is prosecuting me." What's meant there is this sort of clever line that Plutarch sort of explains right before, that there's a joke going around at the time of the prescriptions that people are not being put on because they present a threat. They're not being put on because they're disloyal. They're being put on because they're rich. It's their money that's prosecuting them. It's their money that's killing them. He's being persecuted by his nice house.
Let's move this forward to the second prescriptions then. Let's kind of start with, how did Octavian, Antony, and Lepidus draw up their lists? I mean, I know some of them are going to be quite easy gets. Who are their biggest enemies? Who put a knife in Caesar? That, you know, they kind of are probably going to go first. But what did they want to get out of the lists? What do we know about that?
One of the things that you want to remember is that they're sort of very, very worried. They're trying to sort of cleanse Rome of whom people they see as internal enemies, while also raising money. But a lot of the most obvious candidates are gone. Like Brutus and Cassius are sort of pre-proscribed, right? They've fled. Their sort of life is forfeit if they ever show up in the city of Rome again. They won't. But a lot of the most obvious Republicans have already left the city. There's this line from Appian that I think really gets at how opaque this whole process is. As Appian puts it, as soon as the triumvirs, the three men who form the triumvirate, again, we're talking Octavian, Lepidus, Antony, were by themselves, they joined in making a list of those who were to be put to death. They put on the list those whom they suspected because of their power, and also their personal enemies. And they exchanged their own relatives and friends with each other for death, both then and later. So Appian describes this as wheeling and dealing, right? Almost a process of
negotiation. Well,
if you let me prescribe your first cousin, then I'll let you prescribe my first cousin. I never liked the guy anyway, right? There's no clear rhyme or reason to it. And we're talking a pretty big list. We're talking probably, you know, I want to say around 2,000 is what we think is the data now, right?
Yeah, that's Appian.
Which is an exaggeration over reality, but you know, we're still talking huge numbers, big enough that it can't really be tracked. And it's just chaos deciding who is going to be on this list and who isn't. Presumably, again, there's a much larger role of property seizure here than Appian is acknowledging. It's not just enemies, it's also people who have goods that the triumvirate needs. Also, I think an element of people trying to figure out who they want out of the city of Rome for later, right? One of the things about the second triumvirate as opposed to the first is that it falls apart really quickly. very, very soon, Antony and Octavian especially have gone into a cold civil war, trying to figure out which of these two men is going to end up being the sole ruler of Rome. Everyone knows at this point that you're not actually going to have rule by triumvirate. So I assume also that part of this prescription negotiation is different legs of the triumvirate, different triumvirs, trying to figure out who they want off the chessboard for that later process. And that's why I think you're seeing so much negotiation among the three of them. It's almost the opposite of a sports draft.
So as a result, I mean, one of the most famous people who Appian talks about at this point on the list is Cicero, who Antony hates thanks to the Philippics and Cicero being Cicero, but Octavian is keen to defend, but they kind of trade him off. And then you've got Lepidus's brother, Paulus, being put on that prescription list as well as a bit of a trade.
Cicero is a really interesting figure in this story, right? First of all, let's just say if any of us had to listen to Cicero talk, I'm about 99% sure we wouldn't want him on the list. I mean, really, you read the letters, like the guy is a schmuck, but he's a very, very funny schmuck. And he delivered these unbelievable attacks on Antony. They're very, very funny. I assign the second Philippic constantly. It's wonderful. There's sort of comic set pieces. He at one point says with a straight face that Antony enjoyed the company of mimes of both genders. It's really one of the great masterpieces of insult comedy. But Antony wants this guy dead. Antony's wife wants him deader. She, a woman named Fulvia, appears in our historiography as absolutely loathing Cicero. And in fact, demanding that Cicero, that she be given Cicero's head for her to use as a pincushion.
Yeah, wow.
Antony is pushing for Cicero to be on the list. Octavian loves the guy, and Octavian wants him kept safe. Now, it's true that some of the Philippics praise Octavian. That seems to have been a legitimate alliance. But it's also worth noting that this narrative where Antony, who appears in Plutarch, is dominated by sort of mean, powerful women. Antony and his domineering wife wanted Cicero dead, and Octavian was the guy who protected him. Sort of this very kind of cinematic story at the end of Plutarch's life of Cicero. Let me pull it up. So at the very end of the life of Cicero, Plutarch, remember, writing way after the fact, says, I learned that Octavian, a long time after this, paid a visit to one of his grandsons. And the boy, having in his hands a book of Cicero's, was terrified and sought to hide it in his gown. Octavian saw it and took the book and read it aloud before giving it back to the youth, saying, a learned man, my child, a learned man and a lover of his country. Moreover, as soon as he had finally defeated Antony, and when he was himself consul, Octavian chose Cicero's son as his colleague in the office, and it was in that consulship, so under the consulship of Cicero's son, that the Senate took down the statues of Mark Antony, made void the honors that had been paid him, and decreed that no other man would have the name Mark Antony. Thus, the heavenly powers devolved upon the family of Cicero the final steps in Mark Antony's punishment.
Mm.
This, to me, is both a kind of touching story, right? Cicero's son gets revenge thanks to the intervention of wise Octavian, and points to the role that Cicero is playing in later Octavianic or Augustan propaganda, right? Octavian is portraying his punishment of Mark Antony as revenge for the maltreatment of Cicero. This is one of those stories that immediately makes my ears prick up when I hear about Octavian defending Cicero. Because we have a propaganda tradition painting Octavian as Cicero's friend, follower, and avenger. And that's the propaganda tradition in which these stories of Octavian nobly trying and failing to save his friend, the great orator, are produced.
I can't go past any further without saying a nice Augustus impersonation you had there. Not quite Brian Blessed, but I can see what you were going for.
Aim for pretentious. That's my goal in your imaging. This is a man who sincerely described himself as restoring morals to the city of Rome. I mean, my God, can you? These people just all seem so exhausting, don't you think?
We'll do an episode on the morality laws later on, I think. All right.
Just a heads up, I want to do that. I have whole things about it. I have a whole take. Oh my God.
We'll come into it. All right. So in terms of between these prescriptions and Sulla's prescriptions, were there any difference in how they were conceived, or was it pretty much a copy and paste kind of thing? They were still offering rewards for delivering the people who were prescribed. If you aid somebody who was prescribed, you yourself can be prescribed. It was pretty much the same from the way that I was reading it.
Yeah. I always get nervous with that because our sources are so late. Sources are absolutely copying and pasting. That's sort of a historiographical decision, right? So I think nowadays, if you were to ask most sort of people in the Anglosphere and sort of the English-speaking world to think about the two major wars of the 20th century, our decision to refer to these as the two world wars causes us to see them as similar and maybe to sort of brush past certain differences, right? The way that we name things causes us to sort of blow up their similarities. There's clearly a convention in the history of the first century BC to think of the first prescriptions and the second prescriptions. There are clearly some technological similarities. They're both sort of mass purges, mass seizures of property, and they're clearly using some of the same techniques. But I think it's really hard for us to get at differences between them because that's exactly the kind of thing that is going to drop out of your Appian, drop out of your Dio, drop out of your Plutarch. There is very, very tropey in our later portrayals.
So once they've got their lists, how does this play out in practice? What did the prescriptions of the Second Triumvirate look like in Rome?
So the one that I always think of is sort of Cicero trying as hard as he could to get away, right? We definitely have stories in both prescriptions of people managing to escape the prescription. And that can take a variety of different forms. We certainly have people just sort of escaping from the city of Rome by cover of night and getting as far away as they can, or sort of linking up with other movements. Cicero, for example, is described as not trying to get away and protect himself. He's described as trying to get away to Macedonia to join up with Brutus and Cassius and the Republican revolt. We also have little implications, and these are that people could sort of beg for mercy and get themselves off of the list of the prescribed with certain kinds of politicking. Right? And this, interestingly, is much less present in these later portrayals than it is in one of our only contemporaneous accounts of prescription, the Laudatio Toriae.
So this is a tablet that we've got, a funerary tablet. It's one of the first-hand accounts of what's happening during this time.
Yes. It's a weird document. It's this very, very long inscribed eulogy. Maybe it's recording the words of a eulogy that was actually delivered in person. It's something that would be really hard to know for sure. But it's a eulogy delivered by a widower to his dead wife. It is a remarkable document. She seems like a pretty remarkable woman. She's described as very sort of active in public life. She's sort of getting revenge on people who have slighted her husband in a variety of circumstances. She's this very powerful advocate for him, and he seems clearly to remember that and be extremely grateful for it. It's quite a tender document. But there was a guy, Quintus Lucretius Waspillo, who had a wife named Toria, and we generally associate this couple with the people on the tablet, but there's really no way of knowing for sure. Toria and Quintus, let's go with that, okay? Your guy Quintus. Quintus is prescribed. We have a lot of evidence, by the way, that this guy Quintus actually was prescribed, which is one of the reasons I would do this identity. He goes into hiding, and she, this loyal wife, supports him as he is, again, in flight. He can't access any of his goods. And in this eulogy, Quintus says, "You provided abundantly for my needs during my flight and gave me the means for a dignified manner of living. When you took all the gold and jewelry from your own body and sent it to me and over again enriched me in my absence with servants, money, and provisions, sowing great ingenuity in deceiving the guards posted by our adversaries," right? This suggests, again, sort of an interesting technological component, right? Where he's in hiding. The prescribers have not, I think, prescribed her. After all, if she was prescribed, they'd just kill her. Mm. But they're realizing that this woman who has access to all of this money has every reason to use it to support this guy in hiding. So they are posted guards on her, I think presumably to try and intercept any aid that she's sending and use it to locate him. Then Quintus mentions that thanks to the kindness and judgment of the absent, note that absent, Caesar Augustus, who at this time would have been Octavian, right? Turia dies during the reign of Augustus. The judgment of the absent Octavian, I had been restored to my country as a citizen. Again, Octavian is conveniently out of town for all of this, and it is Lepidus who hears a petition from Turia to have him restored to the citizen roles, right? She lays prostrate at his feet, and she is dragged away sort of brutally, and sounds like kind of beaten up a bit. Although Turia's body was full of bruises, her spirit was unbroken, and she kept reminding Lepidus of Octavian's edict and its expression of pleasure at my, Quintus's, reinstatement. Now look at how this story is being told in this eulogy. In this eulogy, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy? Mm-hmm. It's a lot like what we saw about Cicero, right? Octavian is the good guy. And Lepidus is the one who is trying to keep Quintus proscribed, trying to keep him sort of in danger for his life, even though Octavian Augustus wants him restored to his rights as a citizen, right? It's just sort of an incredible coincidence that the winner of the Civil War happens to have been the one who was protecting everybody who's still alive, right? Everyone owes Augustus a favor. He doesn't seem to have wanted to prescribe anyone in these accounts. And it's stories like this that make me nervous, bluntly, about the accounts of Octavian trying to protect Cicero. It is very clear that Octavian, later Augustus, really wants to minimize his own involvement with the prescriptions. And our entire account of the second prescription especially, I think, has to be read through that lens.
There's a lot of interesting things going on here. But in the drawing up of the prescription list, you get different accounts affording different members of the triumvirate with more of the prescribing. Does that make sense? So you got Dio defending Octavian a lot more. Appian defends Antony because he's in the Antony fan club, and that's kind of what he does. So it depends on who you're reading there. But then you've got this tablet, which is, you know, by all accounts, a first-hand account of somebody who's also invested in living in Augustus's world. So
I was going to say, I mean, these first-hand accounts are in some ways more reliable. You know, there are little details in these accounts that I think you've got to take seriously, right? Like the guards, I believe that because why would you make that up at a eulogy? That just feels like a weird detail. Right? But this guy, Quintus, also has some very direct reasons to lie about other things. You have to sort of consider each claim individually. Quintus is probably going to be more accurate than these later sources about the mechanics of prescription, a topic with which his audience would have been much more familiar than the average reader of Appian or Dio. But he's going to be much less honest about the role of Augustus because he don't want to die.
Yeah, yeah.
Quintus has to be very careful what he says.
It's also interesting that gives us an account of a woman going to speak on her husband's behalf. It also gives the kind of view of what's happening to the people that are left behind. These men are being proscribed. They're trying to flee Rome to save their own lives. They're often leaving their wives and their children behind in Rome to not exactly suffer the consequences, but to definitely, you know, live with the fact that their husbands are prescribed.
To live with it, and also maybe to advocate for them. One of the things that's very important to remember in sort of Republican and Imperial Rome is that we are often given an image of virtuous Roman womanhood. That image owes itself to Augustus a little bit, which I'll talk about more when I'm on talking about the moral legislation. Clearly has roots in a kind of Roman aristocratic ethic, but that don't necessarily reflect reality. In reality, Roman women were highly educated. They were pretty independent by the standards of a lot of ancient societies, and they often had political lives, connections, and juice outside of their husbands. These were women with their own social networks, their own resources, and their own sort of real political gifts. I think very often we shouldn't understand these women as being left behind just to suffer the consequences. They're being left behind as actors and allies and figures who, for a variety of reasons, may not be treated the same as their husbands, but who absolutely can work with them. Roman marriages, it's not the Athenian model where there's just a woman at home weaving wool and sort of any role she plays is seen as ipso facto suspect. Some of these women were quite powerful. Turia seems pretty clearly to have interceded on behalf of her husband and saved his life. We have a record of an oration by the daughter of the great Hortensius, who spared Roman women from taxation by delivering a speech in the Senate shaming the triumvirs for trying to take their money. We have these interesting accounts of female political activity at the moment of the proscription, especially. And I don't think this was the only time that Roman women were ever involved in politics. We can see a lot of sort of maneuvering behind the scenes. I do think it's a moment when that activity became unusually open because of the exigencies of the moment, because these women's husbands were removed from the scene, often killed. These women had space for a kind of open political activity and had to engage in that kind of open political activity when that wouldn't necessarily be the norm for other periods.
The other famous account that we've got, I guess we should go through, is definitely the death of Cicero. And Cicero, we should kind of say, Mark Antony put on the list, but not only that, said that Cicero should be killed first and sent men ahead to Rome to kill Cicero, who luckily, well, not exactly luckily, but got out in time. So what do we know about Cicero's death? What do the accounts tell us about that?
So Cicero's death is this weird, dark, grisly story. I'm obsessed with it. Well, Cicero has fled Rome, but is sold out by a freedman of his brother. This guy who is named Philologus sort of gives Cicero's location to the assassins who go and kill him, as assassins are wont to do, right? It's sort of a very grisly death. Plutarch says at 48:6, Herennius cut off Cicero's head at Antony's commands, and also his hands, the hands that wrote these sort of speeches against him, which we call the Philippics. And when the head and hands were brought to Rome, Antony sees them and orders the head and hands to be placed over the ship's beaks on the rostra, which is a sort of big monument to Roman power in the center of the Roman Forum. And Plutarch has this great line, that Romans saw there not the face of Cicero, remember, a cut off head hanging in the middle of the forum, but an image of the soul of Antony. However, Antony showed at least one sentiment of fair dealing in the case when he handed over Philologus to Pomponia, Cicero's sister-in-law. Pomponia, having got the man into her power, besides other dreadful punishments which she inflicted upon him, forced him to cut off his own flesh bit by bit and roast it and then to eat it. This, indeed, is what some of the historians say. But Cicero's freedman Tiro makes no mention of the treachery of Philologus at all. There's a lot here, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is auto-cannibalism. I don't really hear about this often in the Roman context.
Yeah, it's quite gross, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
On one hand, it is not implausible. Romans could be exceptionally sadistic when dealing with the enslaved and the formerly enslaved. But Plutarch acknowledges here that our evidence for this is very bad. That the actual account of the death of Cicero that comes from Cicero's own freed slave, Tiro, doesn't mention any of this. This props up later in a historiographic tradition. And bluntly, I don't really think it's true. I don't think it's true for a few reasons. remember what I said before about Fulvia and the pincushion?
Yeah.
Sort of Antony's domineering wife coming up with these creative, weird punishments for Cicero. This story is very neat. It is the wife of Cicero's brother coming up with an inventive punishment for the man who killed Cicero. These stories have this almost doubled quality that also plays into a sort of Plutarchic misogyny. Everything here is coming down to these mean, powerful, sadistic, cruel women. And that's too Plutarchic. I sort of don't trust it. It's a well he likes to go to. What I do think is that this story speaks to some tendencies in how Romans thought about the prescriptions, a way that Romans made sense of the prescriptions, and more broadly, used the prescriptions to make sense of the violence of the last days of the Republic.
But as far as the violence goes, one of the elements of this that is pretty much taken as very true is that Cicero's hands and head were put on display in the Forum.
Oh, that I believe.
Yeah, which as I understand it is quite unique for prescription punishment. Like this was just Cicero, and essentially this is just Mark Antony doing it.
It is, but it's worth thinking about why. Cicero is a wildly talented, widely published writer who, incidentally, has kind of proclaimed his allegiance with someone you know you're going to end up in a civil war against soon, right? Antony and Octavian are already kind of aware that that alliance is not long for this earth.
Mm.
There is a distinct value for Mark Antony in making sure that no one is ever going to pretend to be Cicero. This is a dangerous guy to have conspiracy theories around because he's someone who has a reputation as a speechwriter. And Cicero's speeches are being transmitted in writing. That's how a lot of the Philippics went around. There's a real danger in sort of new Philippics cropping up. And I think Antony is publicly announcing this guy is dead in a way that you do it, right? If you want to make sure everybody knows that Cicero is no more, Cicero has ceased to be, this is a rather efficient way of doing it, right?
Yeah, and you're discouraging any copycats that might want to take issue with anything you do in the future, I guess.
I mean, that's also true, but I mean, prescriptions are pretty bloody outright, right? But this is all happening in this sort of gruesome, spectacular manner that still comes off as visceral and frightening 200 years after the fact. This appears in Plutarch and Appian, let alone Dio, as horror stories. These texts are really emotionally powerful. When I assign them in my history classes, I still include trigger warnings. Some students are really upset by these accounts of the prescriptions that are, again, centuries after the fact. And I think that speaks to the distinct role prescription will come to play within the Roman psyche. Mm. One of the things that I think people really underestimate about Augustan propaganda and sort of the way that Augustus presents all of this is that a huge selling point of the age of Augustus is that we're not going to have civil war anymore. Augustus is representing himself as a bringer of peace, as a bringer of an end to this, you know, decades and decades of conflict. So I think that's why he's shown in this sort of oddly positive light in the prescription narratives. Prescriptions are a thing that happened, and Augustus doesn't really want you to forget them. He wants you to be scared of them. That's a big part of sort of what his selling point is. But he wants to minimize his own involvement. The prescriptions appear as this terrible thing that was done by other people, right? And so they're going to survive as a sort of wound in the Roman psyche because they're useful. Emperors want you to remember how awful it is when there's not an emperor. And the prescriptions serve as this sort of scary monument to the dangers of civil war. And I think that's how you got to understand this disgusting story of Pomponia. It takes on the character of urban legend. They were clearly traumatic, but the way they are discussed later on, they become this cultural event, something that people use to understand themselves and understand what Rome means. Mm. Sometimes in the past, I've taught prescriptions through the lens of Holocaust literature, where it's an awful event that society organizes itself around in certain ways, where the memory of this awful thing becomes part of how people, sort of communicate what it means to be Roman, to communicate sort of the dangers of Roman identity. There's a kind of never again to our stories, the prescriptions, right? And I think it's hard for students to really grasp that immediacy and the way that it warps everything without bringing sort of the horrors of our own time.
So the prescriptions were a long process. I mean, I know we're telescoping this into a one podcast episode, but this is something that was drawn out as, I guess, the last people were hunted down, new people were added onto the lists as they offended or did anything against any member of the triumvirate while they were still going. But what is the end outcome? I guess the second triumvirate members managed to purge their enemies and raise a lot of cash and really bring Rome under their heel to a certain extent.
I mean, it depends on what the desired effect was. I think a lot of the desired effect was immediate security and money. On those respects, as best we can tell, they were able to remove some threats to triumviral rule and they raised a fortune. So it worked in that sense. The question is, at what cost? You know, Sulla's prescriptions work, but fairly soon after, Sulla retires from public life and drinks himself to death. I've always sort of thought that what we see there is the last revenge of Roman aristocratic norms, that people were so horrified by the prescriptions that Sulla really was shunned. He plays remarkably little role in Roman politics after his retirement, even considering that he dies pretty soon after. No one seems particularly concerned, and he's not well remembered. This seems like a moment when Rome's aristocratic class was able to say, this is too far. Of course, we'd go back there. Roman political norms are endlessly degrading, but it really seems to have hit a nerve. The second set of prescriptions is a little bit more complicated because Augustus is in power for so long after they occur. He's able to refashion an image of the prescriptions as an awful thing, but a sort of regrettable thing that he is curiously uninvolved in. And he is able to construct an image of himself that consciously excludes them. Now, the price of that is that prescriptions will remain as this horror because Augustus disavows them. Sort of later generations are safe to discuss how awful and violent and scary they really were. But they did the trick.
That was Zachary Herz, legal historian in the Department of Classics at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in any readily available podcasting platform. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both of us on Twitter. Zach is at Zachary Herz. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, the final stand of Brutus and Cassius at the Battle of Philippi. Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.